This is John Abrams, and this is The Variety Artist, episode 70. A lot of people ask me how I book over 100 shows during the summer and how do I keep them organized. Well, here's the secret. It's Pete Ellison's Show Operations. It's software that keeps track of all my contacts, automatically sends contracts and all the docs that my client needs. It even tells me about places to eat near my gig. You'll find the link for Show Ops on my resources page. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/resources to check it out. Pete's even offering a 30-day free trial. That's 30 days of one of the most powerful CRMs available. It's a no-brainer. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
What would you do if you were a world champion juggler and suddenly you lost all coordination in your right arm and you couldn't juggle? What would you do? Well, that's what happened to our guest today. So we're going to find out what he did. Variety Artist, I give you David Diebel. How's it going, David?
I'm doing well. How are you, John?
Well, we're going to jump right in. Tell me, what was your career like, or how did you start juggling? Where did you start all of that?
Well, I was pretty lucky. I grew up in Long Beach, California, and lived very close to a magic club, which also had sort of a juggling branch.
And close to me, too.
Well, yeah. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Torrance, California, which is...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 20 minutes from Long Beach.
Yeah, we're South Bay people.
I know this isn't on the subject, but I saw a video of you performing at the Comedy Magic Club.
Mm-hmm.
Probably my favorite comedy club ever. I've been going there since I was a teenager.
It's probably the best kept secret in comedy. It's a great place, great food, great comedy, and great setting right there on the beach.
Oh, it's wonderful. I love that place. Okay, wait, not enough about memory lane. All right, so what happened? How did you start out juggling and such?
Well, I got involved in magic like a lot of kids. And my local magic store had a magic club affiliated with it. I thought of it, always thought of it as just my local magic club. Later, only much later in life did I realize that it was one of the most best magic clubs in the country, the Long Beach Mystics. And anyway, I started magic, and then I got involved in juggling as well. And I did both for a couple of years. This is ages maybe 10, 11, 12. And then I started doing a little less magic and started pursuing juggling, you know, greater emphasis on juggling. But I've always had a foot in the magic world, and I know a little bit about magic, but I get fooled easily, and I'm not one of these people who have to know how every magic trick works. In that sense, I'm much more of a layman, but I do know a lot of magicians.
I'm with you on that. I love going to the Magic Castle. I love being fooled.
Yeah. Was that true? I never knew. I always thought magicians always needed to know. I know a lot of laypersons need to know. They almost feel uncomfortable if they don't. But no, I'm perfectly content to be fooled and just enjoy the ride.
I love it. It's part of the ride. Exactly.
Have you ever seen a magic trick that fooled you where you absolutely had to know?
Not really. If I have to know, usually I buy the trick and I practice it, figure it out, and I end up doing it.
Right. You know, you have that option.
So you join this magic club and you start juggling a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I start juggling, doing magic, and started performing right away. I mean, even before I joined the magic club around the ages of 8 or 9, even 7, I was doing magic shows in my garage with for my cousins, or, you know, any kids in the neighborhood who would watch. So I was very precocious in that sense. And then when I joined the Long Beach Mystics, I had lots of opportunities to perform and grow a lot. I think that's one of the chief characteristics of my career, is I started very, very early.
So when did you start competing?
Well, in juggling, I did my first IJA competition, which is the International Jugglers Association, when I was 12. I took fifth place in the juniors category.
Nice.
Which is very good, considering, you know, I had only been juggling, less than 2 years at that point. The following year, 1983, I was 13, and then I won. Oh. And that was the last time I competed. It should be worth saying that my coach was Long Beach Mystic Randy Pryor, who taught me how to juggle, and he also coached my friend Rick Coleman to second place. So I think we were probably the best coached jugglers at that convention.
Once you competed and you became, I guess that would be junior world champion, right?
Technically, I was the best of those who showed up. You know how it is. It's not like the Olympics or anything. But I was the IJA junior champion.
So then did you start a career in juggling? Well, you're only 13 or 14 years old.
Yeah, I was performing at that point, but obviously I wasn't doing it full time. I had only just started high school at that point, I would think. I did a lot of shows with the Long Beach Mystics. We had a 72-hour magic juggle-a-thon, I remember, to raise funds for the club, where we put on this show outside in the parking lot outside of the magic store, where you'd have a show going on lasting 72 hours. Of course, you'd show up at 2 in the morning. It would just be Kevin James telling stories about growing up in Michigan or what have you. But during the day, if anybody was there, they had a show that they could watch. I did shows called It's Amazing, which was sort of the Long Beach Mystics version of It's Magic. And then whatever other shows I could get publicly. I mean, I think I did my first comedy club around the age of 18 and, you know, country clubs, local shows, that sort of thing.
And then did that progress into a career in juggling?
I've never had a job. Let me see. After high school, I went to Europe. I did some busking, street performing in Munich and Switzerland with a friend of mine. Mm. Then coming back, some more comedy clubs in Chicago and Midwest. I started doing cruise ships and just a little bit of everything.
You're traveling around the world. You're doing your act. So then what happens?
Yeah, let me see. I was performing with my coach, the guy who taught me how to juggle, Randy Pryor, on a cruise ship. And I was practicing one day between shows, and I noticed I had some problem with my right arm. It was kind of pronating, and I would kind of, my palm would hit my rib cage when I juggled. And basically, the quick, dirty version of it is that I had lost my coordination. I could no longer juggle. And there's no pain involved or anything like that, no balance issues or headaches, just this coordination problem.
So how old are you about when you discovered this?
I was 22.
Okay.
So I took it up with anybody who would listen, which is mostly my juggling friends. And a lot of them became fascinated by it. They came up with all these frontier remedies. One developed a sling made out of rubber tubing for me to wear. Try this. Gave me a throw pillow. He said, put this throw pillow under your armpit. Maybe it'll recruit different muscle groups, what have you. Nothing really seemed to work. It became pretty clear after a while that I was going to have to, if I was going to stay in show business, develop some sort of workaround. So that's when I started collaborating with my friend John Held and others to begin performing those things that I could perform. And a lot of those things were things I just made up. Performing, you know, I started rolling an apple down my back and piercing it between my legs with a fork. Or kicking a billiard ball in the air. I catch it nestled in my eye socket. So all of these different things that I could do that didn't involve my right hand so much or at all. I also found that it was really good because my act became a lot more original. It forced me to focus my mind, to really focus on getting new material, doing things that nobody else is doing, rather than just doing my version of, you know, a standard, you know, juggling routine.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to ask that. Do you think that if this never happened, you would have continued, you know, juggling whatever, you know, balls, pins, things like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've asked myself that, and I really don't know. I mean, obviously, I would not have had the incentive and I wouldn't have felt the urgency to come up with new things. On the other hand, I was pretty well taught about performing, and I always did comedy. I always did talking. My sense is that I probably wouldn't have it to the same degree that I ended up, you know, going up off in this different direction. But I don't know that I would have been remained a totally conventional juggler. So the ultimate answer is I really don't know. It's one of those things. What would you have done if things had been different? Well, who knows? My answer is maybe.
Because things aren't different.
I mean, now I should add that since then, over the last few years ago, I was drawing by hand some utensils and putting them in the utensil drawer. And I was doing this weird little flourish with them with my bad arm. Mm. My problem was always task specific. That is to say, it only impacted my juggling. And then about 4 years ago, it started creeping into other things like putting away utensils, cutting vegetables, trimming vegetables, holding a coffee cup, shaving, brushing my teeth. So over the last few years, it's gotten worse in the sense that it's expanding into everyday activities. Mm. But on the other hand, it's not getting any worse for my act. You know, I have had to switch things around. Like I always kept a bottle of water on my right side. I can't hold a cup of water with my right hand anymore, so I switched it over to my left side, and now my props are on the right. When I'm holding a microphone, I pretty much have to hold it with my left hand. And some of the workarounds that I came up with, like the apple and fork trick that I mentioned before, I've had to learn with my left hand, so I'm doing workarounds of my workarounds. But on the other hand, it's been good, too. It's made me practice a bit more because I'm relearning these skills with my left hand. And also, I realized my wife helped me a lot with this in that, you know, in juggling, there's a fine line between dropping and dropping too much. I mean, you drop some, you have some great, hilarious lines to say, and the audience loves it. But, you know, there's a fine line. It can't really be defined, but where you drop too much, and then the audience, it just starts feeling awkward.
Yeah.
And so I took that to heart. I mean, as a performer, you intuitively know when that happens just as well as the audience. So, for example, I developed this rule for myself where if I didn't get something on the second try, not everything, but if it's a little thing, like trying to throw a billiard ball in the air, I try to catch it on my forehead. Mm-hmm. I have to do that left-handed now. I can't do it with my right. And if I don't get it on the second try, what I do is I just put it up there, you know, which gets a laugh because, you know, try to throw it, fail, try to throw it, fail. And then just put it up there. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, I would be quite insistent on getting it right. Now, I have this kind of peace of mind knowing, listen, if you don't get it second try, Dave, just work around it, you know, skip it, and focus more on keeping the flow going.
Nobody feels uncomfortable when that happens. If you keep dropping it and dropping and dropping it, it becomes uncomfortable for you. It becomes uncomfortable for the audience.
Yeah.
What do you see as your future? Do you know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, short term, I'm being pressed to my limits now. A lot of my clients lately need two different 45-minute shows, which for me, you know, it's doable. But, you know, if I start losing some of these skills, I'll give an example. And I do a thing where I balance a coat hanger on my forehead and there's a marshmallow on the hook. And I have to light the marshmallow on fire while it's balanced on my forehead.
Oh, the old marshmallow on the forehead trick. It's the one that everybody does, right?
Pretty standard, really, as Dr. Evil would say. But I can no longer light it with my right hand. So I'm learning to light it with my left hand, which sounds easy. Why that's any more difficult, I can't explain. So I'm working on that, but if I lose that or lose other things that I can't do with my left hand, then I'm going to have to come up with something else.
Mm.
One thing that occurred to me recently is maybe get a joke book. Now, I never want to be the guy who tells jokes, but, you know, I have a lot of stand-up comedy that I'm very proud of. Very original to me. Virtually half of every act I do is stand-up comedy. So I don't really feel like I need to establish my bona fides as a funny spoken word comedian. On the other hand, you know, if I need to, it could be, I could get a joke book. There are some fantastic joke books out there, you know, open public domain joke books, and maybe throw in some jokes because, you know, I only need a couple of minutes here and there if I, you know, I'm not going to lose my entire act overnight.
Sure.
You know, the stand-up comedy, you know, comes along at its own pace. Like I said, I can't really effectuate that. But I could see myself at the end of the show telling some jokes that nobody's heard before. My one reservation is that more people will come up to me after a show and start telling me their jokes, because every comedian hates that, as you can imagine. Oh my God. But if that's what it takes to stay afloat, that's what I'll do.
Yeah, I get that as a magician too. The exact same thing. I'm sure you probably get this as a juggler. I'll finish my show and somebody will come up to me. Oh, have you seen this trick?
Yeah, you know what? That's worth saying. You know, I got a friend named Phil Tagg. He's a fantastic stand-up comedian. He's done The Tonight Show. He paneled with Johnny Carson. And this guy is like an A-plus comedian. Great material, great delivery, and just make you laugh out loud. But when I work with him on cruise ships, he'd come out and he'd do that old gag, "Let's hear it for my close personal friend," and then he'd look at his palm. Steve Reiner, you know. Yeah. And that was great to learn, because I realized that, you know, this guy doesn't need help. He's got his own material, very funny, but if he needs to go out and do an old gag right up front just to get that first laugh out of the way and kind of get comfortable and make a connection with the audience, and he's not above doing that. I mean, that might be something for your listeners to consider from time to time.
Do you think your audience would notice if you change things up?
I often think, what if I had to do my show in tennis shoes? I could always wear a suit, but what if I had to wear tennis shoes with my suit or something? And I get worked up into this frenzy, like I have to say something, explain why I'm wearing tennis shoes, or, you know, what have you. And the truth is, if I don't say anything, they don't even notice. You know, if I could focus on it, but chances are it won't be funny. It'll just be awkward. And so you got to kind of distinguish between those things that you as an artist are preoccupied with and those things which kind of resonate with the audience.
Interesting, because the audience looks at you when you come up on stage and they assume what you are is what you are.
I tell myself that. The audience doesn't know what it's missing. I mean, sometimes on cruise ships, I have to do two different 45-minute shows, and I've been mixing things up. I always like to do things I'm comfortable with up front in the first show and then just kind of roll the dice on the second show. And I've been changing this, and I think, boy, if they don't see this bit in the first show, they're not going to come back to the second show, blah, blah, blah. And I just started thinking, you know, the audience, they know nothing. They haven't seen your act. They don't know what they're missing. If you don't have a tie on, it makes no real difference. Just keep your eyes on the prize and focus on what you have to do. And don't think about your shoes or your tie or the fact that, you know, you have a chip in your billiard ball or what have you.
I ran into this just day before yesterday, I think it was. I had to do two shows back to back. And the first one, they were really tight together time-wise. I suggested that I shorten the first one. And the person that I was talking to said, well, you know, you can shorten it, but, you know, the first group won't get the full experience. And I said, well, they won't know what they're missing. Because the truth is, if you leave something out of your show, they really don't know that that's missing. They've never seen it. They see what they see. And if it's satisfying and wonderful and fun for them, then that's what they get. And that's what they expect. And that's what they have.
Sure, there's worse things than, you know, leaving them wanting a little bit more. I mean, it's one thing to cut it really short by time, but if you can do a great 30 minutes doing one thing instead of 15 things, to me, as long as it adds up to 30, something close to it, that's what's most important.
Yeah, and if it works with the schedule and it has a beginning, middle, end, through line of action, all those things, then it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like with drop lines. You know, juggling, we call them drop lines. When you drop, you say something funny. And I have a few really good ones, but I have often thought, you know, what if I had like 20 where I could drop 20 times in a show? I wonder if even that would get tedious as long as I had something hilarious to say. I guess if it was hilarious, then by definition, they'd be fine with it. But I think at some point, the audience, they don't want perfection, but they do like to see some level of competence. I'm not a total, I mean, mine is kind of an act of errors, a comedy of errors, but at some point, I mean, a comedy of errors is great, but it's even better if you can at some point really dazzle the audience with skill.
Yeah. When you overcome that obstacle, it becomes more successful for the audience too.
Oh, sure. I don't know if they say it magic, but in juggling, if you get something on the third try, it very often gets the best response. Because there's always tension, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of comedy is creating tension in a setup and then releasing the tension in the punchline. And so my friend Dan Holzman taught me this, you know, when you drop a prop, it automatically creates tension. And that's a great opportunity for comedy because so much of comedy is just release and the release of tension.
Yeah, both in magic, comedy, probably juggling too. There's magic in threes.
Especially in magic, I think there's, you know, juggling too, there's the convention where the gentleman juggler, the gentleman magician who's in total control, he's taking off the white gloves and he's like almost 007. That's, I think, kind of ripe for satire. Like one thing I learned from Steve Martin, he made it huge in the 70s at a time when like people were wearing these ridiculous platform shoes and glittery clothing and massive sunglasses. And he was wearing something that was downright a throwback, a suit.
Yeah.
And he said, because he understood that if he looked crazy and acted crazy, that he would be like a lot of acts, especially in the 70s. But if he looked conventional and acted crazy, then he would be onto something. There's a tension there between the way you look and your demeanor and what you actually do that I find very easy to get laughs.
I like the idea of wearing the suit. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about with the Steve Martin thing, and even back further what we were talking about. When the audience sees you walk in with a suit, they assume one thing, and it's probably easy to do comedy if you go the complete opposite direction like Steve Martin did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, also, I always imagine, I mean, what if you get a heckler or something? Do you want to be wearing a glittery vest? I mean, I want to be wearing a suit and tie and have a microphone. I mean, there are other practical reasons. I like having the option of going straight to the bar or hanging out with audience members after the show. And I don't want to be wearing a costume or anything like that. I'm a big fan of normal. To me, nothing is more normal than a suit.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. Now, tell me about your running. Do you do a lot of running? I was stalking your Facebook, and there were some running posts on there.
Oh, yeah. I'm an avid runner. I'm injured right now, unfortunately. I've got a little foot injury, and it's great for me with all my traveling and stuff. I like how it goes back to performing, too. I like minimalism, so I love just having needing nothing but a pair of running shoes and some shorts or what have you, and being able to put them in my backpack. And it doesn't matter if I'm at a hotel, I can run on the treadmill if the weather's bad, or on a cruise ship, I can run. I can do it anytime I want. It's a great way to stay fit, and I enjoy the outdoors.
Perfect. And you can see the sights wherever you are.
Yeah, well, it's a great way to look around. I'm not a spiritual person, but it is kind of a great way to clear your head. And
I do the same. Well, I don't run, but I hike a lot, and I find it's the perfect way to clear my mind. And
oh, yeah.
You know, anytime I'm brainstorming on a brand new show or something like that, you know, during a hike is the perfect peaceful way to do it.
You know, for me, like with my stand-up, I'm not one of those who sits down and, okay, I'm going to write jokes now. I just write things down as they come to me, and they often come to me in the shower or on a run, what have you. And I can't really control it. It's like either sometimes the antenna, I tell my wife, you know, because I'll be on my phone while we're, I don't know, at the grocery store, and I have to explain to her that I'm getting the signal. You know, it's like these invisible antenna come up, and all of a sudden I start getting jokes and I have to write them down.
Yeah.
I think as long as I'm kind of getting the signal that I have an obligation, it's in my interest to write it down and try it out for audiences.
Sure. And in fact, writing it down is a good practice too, because I myself have a tendency to forget. If I don't write it down right now, as I hear it, as I feel the inspiration, get the joke in my head, I'll forget. And then a week later, I'll say, oh, yeah, I was thinking about that thing. And then I can't put it back together.
If I don't do a show for a couple of weeks, I look over my notes and I kind of highlight those things that I want to try. I think it's essential to write it down.
Oh, yeah. Now, we're going to switch gears. Normally, I would do fact or something John just made up right here, but I'm just going to give you a couple of random thoughts, and maybe you can fill me in on something that may have happened to you. How about that?
Sure.
Okay. Here's one. David once had a volunteer bring up his own what looked like drumsticks. One of your volunteers for a show?
Oh, yeah. I didn't bring the guy on stage. I do a thing where I just ask a volunteer to stand up in his seat. If I'm explaining what I need him to do, he's got what appears to be a bunch of, like, I don't know, half a dozen drumsticks in his hand. Mm-hmm. And he's wearing these sunglasses indoors, and it's kind of distracting. And finally, I just asked him if he would mind setting down the sticks, so I could focus. And he kind of opens up his hands, and these sticks, like in a flash, just assemble into a white cane with a red tip right in front of everyone. He holds it up in the air, and he's obviously blind. And yeah, the place went absolutely nuts. And it was funny, you know, because what I needed him to do required a certain amount of coordination, which I couldn't expect of a blind guy. So that was, I probably should have mentioned that up front. But yeah, that's, those things happen every now and then. And
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh. But that's funny. You're thinking, well, maybe I'll bring him to the next show, so it'll be, you know, I'll get a big laugh.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. That, I've been terrible. I mentioned this in my notes about writing down stories, funny things that happen. But that's one I think I'll always remember.
That's a good one. Now, you were the only juggler to appear on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Is that right?
Yeah. There was Jay Leno. I've heard that personally, he's a big fan of stand-up. He is a stand-up. The Jay Leno era was not known as, you know, showcasing variety acts.
In fact, it's funny. We started this podcast out with the Comedy Magic Club. Jay Leno used to, I don't know if he does anymore, go there every week to try out his material, right?
I know during the Tonight Show, he liked to go there on Sunday nights to work on his, what do they call the thing at the beginning?
The opening monologue. Yeah. He'd break out a piece of paper, and he'd actually read jokes from the piece of paper, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I remember he would just read them without, as you wouldn't say them, but he just read them in a very clinical manner, just to try to get the raw response to see if there was a joke there at all. But yeah, he's a great comedian.
Do you have some advice for maybe the beginner or the pro for us?
I would say with the beginner is to take baby steps and don't overextend. You know, there's something to be said for staying in your comfort zone. I mean, I think of stand-up comedy, you know, I've only been doing stand-up for a little more than 10 years now. So when I started, you know, I had my variety act ready to go. I mean, I would go to open mics in Denver to try to do, you know, 5 minutes of stand-up. And if I panicked and I didn't, you know, or if I forgot my joke, I blanked or what have you, I always had little things in my pocket that I could do from my act, you know, from my variety act. Mm-hmm. But I noticed a lot of other aspiring comedians really didn't care if they weren't going over well. I remember speaking to this guy at an open mic night who was really bad. And he told me that he recently did a 2-hour show. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, I guess you could do a 2-hour show if you really don't care how good it is.
Yeah.
So I think, right, I'd say at the beginning, just, you know, work on that first minute or first 30 seconds. You know, there's nothing that says you have to have 5 minutes right out of the gates. Mm. And it's a gradual process. And as you get more experience, you get more confidence. And then as you get more confidence, you know, the audience senses it, and that it sort of becomes self-reinforcing. You know, don't be afraid to take baby steps and come up with a great 2-minute act.
How about a recommended book for us?
Oh, sure. The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. It's a fantastic book. It's not The Art of War. It's The War of Art. Yep. Stephen Pressfield is a screenwriter. He wrote a movie, what is it? The Legend of Bagger Vance, I think it's called.
With Will Smith.
Okay, yeah. I'm sure I've seen it. What is he, a caddy or a golfer?
I think so, yeah.
And The War of Art, it's a fascinating book. Much of it is about what he calls the resistance. And he uses capital R because the resistance, it's an entity. It's a living thing. And it lives for only one purpose, and that is to thwart you in doing your job, in writing new material, coming up with a new routine, in making those phone calls. And it's really pernicious because it can take all sorts of forms. It can be, of course, laziness. It can be distractions. And he has a great chapter on being a professional, because the professional realizes something that the amateur doesn't. The professional realizes, I have work to do. I don't have to take this phone call. I have work to do. You know, yeah, the weather's beautiful outside, and I would love to go for a hike or a run or have a cup of coffee, but there's work that needs to be done. It's an incredible wealth of knowledge in the book. I mean, from beginning to end, and like virtually all great personal growth books, self-help books, it's very short. It can literally be read in one sitting, but it's Stephen Pressfield, Pressfield.
Yeah, it's a highly recommended book by a lot of people.
Hopefully I'm the first one. If I can come up with another one, if you like.
No, you're actually the first one on this podcast, but I've heard that from a lot of other people.
Oh, good. I've read it twice. I mean, honest to God, it's worth keeping around, because sometimes you just need to read it again. It's that good of a book.
Now, you're speaking at Magic Live, or what are you doing at Magic Live? Well, first, even before you to say what you're doing, what is Magic Live for people who don't know what that is?
My friend founded it, Stan Allen. I've known Stan since I was 10 years old.
Yep, Stan Allen, for anybody listening to this that doesn't know who that is, he was also the founder and publisher of Magic Magazine, right?
That's right. And so now I've attended Magic Live, I think, twice in the past, but only as a performer, never as somebody who's there from beginning to end, fully immersed. But I think it's a fully immersive experience. I remember one year they had this sort of adventure theme where you were given this map and a compass and clues. And all I know is that my colleagues in the world of magic absolutely rave about it.
Yep.
And I am very privileged to be part of it.
Oh, okay. I think Magic Live is August 4th through 7th of this year. Boy, that's like next week. Now, what are you doing for them?
Well, I can't really talk. I you know what? If I told you, I'd have to kill you. I will be doing something at Magic Live. Let's just leave it at that. I know the powers that be like to leave such things in the air until the event actually happens, but I don't think they'd mind if they mentioned that I am, in fact, performing in some official capacity at Magic Live, but we'll just have to leave it at that.
No problem. People that are there will see you there and see you perform and do something, right?
I would love to meet anybody. Yeah, please come and say hello.
Well, thanks, David, for doing my podcast. This was fun.
Hey, it's my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Oh, I appreciate it. Now, where can someone get a hold of you, or do you have some social media to promote?
Well, let me see. I don't have my handles handy, but probably the best place is just via Facebook, David Diebel. There might be one other David Diebel, but if you put my name in the Facebook search engine, I think you should have no difficulty finding me.
Oh, excellent.
Best place, or worst comes to worst. How do you say that? Worst comes to worst.
Whatever.
One of those phrases. You can always visit my website, which is my name, daviddiebel.com. And from there, you can find links to my email and all my social media.
Well, thanks again, David. And thanks to all of my variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, tell a friend to listen. Say, listen to this podcast. That's how we can spread the word. You can reach me on Facebook, message me there, or join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.